In the matter of State versus Andrea Dunbrack and State versus Gabriel Rodriguez, can we please have appearances of counsel? Starting with the Mercer County Prosecutor.
Good afternoon, Arlene Tanzimir on behalf of State.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Laura Monfiglio on behalf of the Attorney General as amicus.
Peter Blum, Assistant Deputy Public Defender on behalf of Gabriel Rodriguez.
And Robin Lord on behalf of Andrea Dunbrack. Good afternoon as well, Your Honors.
Welcome, everyone. Ms. Casimir, please proceed. And again, thanks, everyone, for muting when you're not speaking.
Thank you. May it please the court. I would like to request 2 minutes rebuttal time.
Casimir, we can't hear you. Are you speaking now?
Yes, I am speaking. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes. Keep the phone a little bit closer than you had, and please proceed.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court. I would like to request 2 minutes for rebuttal. If the appellate division's decision is upheld, trial court in every robbery trial will be forced to charge sua sponte jurors on theft as a lesser included offense, even when, as in this present case, such a charge is not clearly indicated in the record. Indeed, in reaching its decision, the appellate division failed to point to facts in the record that clearly indicated that a jury could convict the defendant of the lesser included offense of theft and acquit of the greater offense of robbery. Because the appellate division's decision is contrary to well-established case law, it must be reversed, and the convictions of the defendants must be reinstated. The trial court's duty to instruct jurors on a lesser included offense is governed by two separate standards. The standards are the rational basis as well as clearly indicated. These standards apply in different circumstances. The rational basis standard applies when counsel makes a request for a lesser included offense or objects to the charge of a lesser included offense. Here, in this case, the appellate division correctly determined that the clearly indicated standard applies, although it failed to properly evaluate that standard. Trial courts have a duty to instruct a jury sua sponte only where the facts and evidence clearly indicate that the appropriateness of the charge. Clearly indicated means that evidence supporting the lesser included offense must jump off the page to trigger the court's duty to sua sponte instruct of the lesser included offense. Now, what jump off the page means is that courts are not required to comb through the statute to find an uncharged offense that the defendant could be found guilty of, and neither are the courts required to meticulously sift through the entire record to see if a combination of facts and inferences might rationally sustain the charge. In essence, it must be clear that the jury could convict of the lesser included offense and could acquit of the greater offense based on the evidence that is presented. In the present case, the evidence presented through testimony did not cause an instruction of theft as a lesser included offense to jump off the page. Rather, the evidence demonstrated that what occurred was a robbery. We do have evidence from the victim. When the victim testified, he explained that the defendant, one of the co-defendants, Mr. Rodriguez, approached him while he was in a bar and told him that he could take him home and he would provide him with a cheap taxi. The victim is not the one who approached Mr. Rodriguez. He did not go to him and say that he needed the right home. Rather, it is the opposite. And also, the evidence shows that the defendant drove the victim to a location, to the parking lot of an abandoned building, and there the victim stated that Mr. Rodriguez approached him and pointed a weapon at him, pointed a handgun at him, and also told him to give him his phone and his money. Then he proceeded to strike the victim in the face. The victim went unconscious and woke up in the hospital. However, Ms. Dunbrack's story is that Mr. Rodriguez was driving her back from Atlantic City, and he wanted to go out and decided to stop in Trenton. He went inside a bar, left her in the vehicle. She then became upset and wanted to leave, but stayed when she realized she did not know where she was. And as she was going inside the bar to go find Mr. Rodriguez, her co-defendant, she saw Mr. Rodriguez walking out of the bar with the victim. She stated that she was upset with the defendant. So instead of sitting in the front passenger seat, she sat in the back seat next to the victim, who is a stranger. Then she stated that the victim began to try to assault her. And it is at that point that the co-defendant struck the victim, and also that she kicked the victim in the vehicle, and that she also sprayed mace on the victim. The robbery was interrupted by police officers. Who noticed a car in a park close to an abandoned a building, as well as having the headlights on and doors to the car open. And when they approached, they observed the victim on the ground, naked. The defendant, co-defendant Rodriguez, ran, and co-defendant Dunbrack was detained. The victim was unconscious. He did not have his clothes on. His personal belongings were found on the front seat, such as his passport, his wallet, his money, and even his pants. His shoes were found on the back seat of the vehicle. There was a small fire that was started near the victim. And all of that points to a robbery as opposed to a theft. Now, defense counsel in its closing argument argued that really this is akin to a theft after an altercation. However, the evidence does not show that this is a theft. This was a theft after an altercation. In fact, it points to a robbery, not just based on the evidence presented by the victim, but also based on other evidence, such as the victim's other belongings, such as passport, wallet, and money, been found on the front passenger seat, where the testimony was that a testimony from both the victim and co-defendant Dunbrack was that the victim was in the rear passenger seat, and then he was taken from the vehicle. He was dragged out of the vehicle by co-defendant Rodriguez. Really, all of that points to a completed robbery. And again, the supposed fight only did not stop voluntarily. There was no break in the event. In fact, officers came on the scene, and when they came on the scene, they found the victim unconscious and naked. Now, based on the testimony of Ms. Dunbrack, she could not explain how in the short time that she exited the vehicle and the co-defendant pulled the victim out of the vehicle, he came to be completely naked. She could not explain why his passport, as well as money, as well as wallet, were on the front seat. She did not have
Ms. Casimir, Ms. Casimir, may I ask a question? You've presented an argument that the jury accepted that there was strong evidence of a robbery based on the evidence presented in the case here. Can you respond to the defendant's argument that one can infer theft from the record as well, and that that's why that charge should have been there? Can one infer theft? Why or why not?
In terms of inferring theft, the record is clear. It is more of robbery as opposed to making an inference for theft. And the reason why is because of the set of facts, the totality of the circumstances, the fact that the victim was lured out of the bar with the promise of a cheap taxi ride, the fact that he was not taken directly to the address that he gave the co-defendant, but rather he was driven to an abandoned building in Hamilton, additionally,
Ms. Casimir, I want to follow up with the chief so we can focus on the issue that's before the court. It's not for this court to determine whether or not the defendant is guilty of theft or robbery. The only issue before us is whether or not there was a basis to charge theft, given the clearly indicated standard. So my question to you is, which you used the jumped off the page metaphor, at the charge conference, counsel for Ms. Dumbrat specifically indicated that theft was a possibility, was one of the alternatives given her testimony. Her testimony was that she was sexually assaulted in the back seat, that she fought off the victim, and then her co-defendant may have then beat him up and ran off with part of his property. So, and that's what Rodriguez's attorney said in summation. Went with Dumbrat and said, wasn't a robbery, may have taken something he wasn't entitled to. So wasn't this issue right before the jury? The judge did not have to meticulously sift through the transcripts. The issue was placed right before the judge. Maybe the charge wasn't requested, but it was right before the judge. So therefore, why wasn't the judge obligated to charge theft as a lesser included based upon the defense theory?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason why the judge was not obligated to charge sua sponte theft as a lesser included offense is because although there was the argument that was made, although that those facts were presented by Ms. Dunbragg in her testimony, however, defense counsel's argument in doing closing is not evidence. That is not considered evidence. So the court is not obligated to make a determination as to clearly indicated based on counsel's summation. And in terms of the theft as a lesser included offense,
can it be said here that the purpose of this was the attempt at sexual assault, and then the theft came as an afterthought, that the violence was not because of the theft, but rather because of by the testimony of the defendants themselves, the violence came from the attempted assault, and then the theft came as an afterthought, in which case the charge would not be warranted, would it?
I apologize. I could not hear, Your Honor.
I said, based on the testimony of the defendants, it appears that the violence occurred as a result of the attempted assault on Ms. Dumbrack, not as an effort to commit the theft. The theft came as an afterthought. If those are the facts presented by the defendants at trial, the theft charge would not be called upon because the theft was not the cause of the violence, but rather an afterthought. So then the charge would not be called for.
In this case, during the charging conference, the defendant, the attorney for Ms. Dunbragg, did mention this as a lesser included offense, but really stated that he was just throwing it out there. And really the charge that the attorney was more concerned with, it was a charge of justification. Defense of oneself and defense of others. So with that, with her testimony, it was clear that the justification that the attorney wanted the jury to present was that of justification, as opposed to the theft. A lesser included offense, and that is why the state argued that the rational basis standard should not apply, but rather it has to be the clearly indicated. And with the clearly indicated, there must be something that jumps off the page, stating that the jurors could acquit of the theft. Convict of the theft and acquit of the robbery. However,
counsel, we're focusing on the clearly indicated standard and whether or not it was met here. Now, in this instance, I'm curious your position as to how far the court can go with inferences when you're dealing with the clearly indicated standard. Because in this instance, Ms. Dunbrack didn't say anything really about the theft. She said that her companion was trying to protect her from a sexual assault. She didn't know how any of the victim's property ended up on the front seat, and she didn't speak about the cell phone at all that I saw in the record. So in a case decided not that long ago in Funderburg, where we had to decide whether something was clearly indicated, we were not willing as a court to draw inferences about a defendant's state of mind based on circumstances of an altercation in that setting. And yet here it seems as if we are grappling with whether unstated, there's no testimony about this theft occurring after the event took place. We're all working on the basis of inferences. And do inferences satisfy the clearly indicated standard when we're in this kind of a setting? It seems contrary to the Funderburg comparison.
Yes, Your Honor. The state would ask that, Your Honor, by your decision, by the court's decision in Funderburg, and clearly indicated does not mean that the court has to make certain inferences as to pretty much it doesn't mean that the court has to comb through the evidence as well as also try to weigh the facts, make certain inferences in order to come to the decision that the lesser included charge should be instructed to the jury.
There has to be a meaningful difference. Do you not agree, between the rational basis test and the clearly indicated? And what I'm asking you is, I'm perceiving from our case law on those two standards that inferences can't just materialize out of thin air based on the totality of evidence. In those cases, there was something to grab onto from the direct testimony of a witness. And here we have nothing on theft coming out of the mouth of Ms. Dunbrack. So I am puzzled with where we can find the necessary support in this record for theft.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is correct. That is correct. Rational basis and clearly indicated are two separate standards. And in fact, clearly indicated is the higher standard. It requires more. From the trial court, and there was no testimony as to the theft from Ms. Dunbrack.
Why does there have to be testimony of theft just from Dunbrack? Don't we look at all of the evidence? Dunbrack claimed that she fought off a sexual assault, and then Rodriguez ran away after the sexual assault with the victim's personal belongings. He's not entitled to do that. That's an afterthought theft. That's testimony in the record. And it was also summed up by the defense counsel. So there was no sifting through the record. It was displayed right before the trial judge. And he had an independent obligation, regardless of request to charge, based upon our case law in Powell and Green, to give the charge, regardless of the strategic maneuverings of counsel. Am I mistaken about that?
Your Honor, with respect to the argument made by counsel during summation, that is not evidence. It is not considered evidence.
It doesn't have to be evidence, but he's telling the judge what his theory of the case is. I mean, so the judge doesn't have to figure it out. He's given it to him on a silver platter. This is the theory of the case. I stole the guy's goods after he attempted to rape my friend.
Did he testify?
He did not testify. Your Honor, that is the theory of the case. But the clearly indicated standard that is well established requires that the trial court looks at the evidence that is presented, not the theory of the case, but rather the evidence. And based
does
on
Ms.
the evidence,
Dunbrack ever say, or does any witness ever say, when Mr. Rodriguez picked up that wallet, whether it was before or after this so-called altercation, which is characterized in different ways by the parties?
Ms. Dunbrack did not testify that she could not explain how the wallet came to be on the front seat. She could not explain any of that, really.
Right.
However, the victim did testify that when they took him to the abandoned to the parking lot of the abandoned building, the defendant approached him, opened the door to the back seat, pointed a gun at him, and told him, "Give me your phone and your wallet." He stared.
So there's no testimony about the taking after the fact. There's nothing in the record about that, is there?
There was no testimony regarding that. In fact, the phone was not discovered until co-defendant Rodriguez was apprehended, because he was apprehended and was searched. Now, there's one point I would like to make clear with regards to inference and evidence. There was no testimony as to the theft. Therefore, the court would have to make an inference that is not required by the clearly indicated standard. However, with respect to the victim's testimony, there is plenty of evidence to support the robbery. We have his wallet being on the front seat with no one being given explanation as to how that happened. There was no testimony that at any point he was on the front passenger seat of the vehicle. And also his passport was located there. His passport was located there, as well as his money, his pants. His shoes were in the back of the vehicle, on the middle back seat. He was found unconscious and completely naked. while there has to be an inference made that, oh, maybe that the phone that Mr. Rodriguez rang, the phone, it was a theft after a fight as opposed to a robbery, the evidence shows that this is a robbery that was completed. And in addition, rebuttal testimony also contradicted the testimony of Ms. Dunbrack, where Ms. Dunbrack stated that she sprayed mace on the victim while she was in the vehicle. And there was no evidence of the smell of mace in the area or on the victim anywhere. And also she testified that the victim was, that co-defendant hit the victim in the vehicle, causing him to bleed in the vehicle. And there was no evidence of blood or traces of blood in the vehicle. So that is where the difference lies.
Ms. Casimir, is your argument in essence that there is nothing that clearly indicates the appropriateness of a theft charge because there is nothing in the record, no evidence in the record in support of that charge?
That is correct.
And
is there anything
and
you'd like to
say? Oh, sorry,
please.
Chief. And
go
just
ahead.
To go off something, the questions that Justice LaVecchia was asking, is it your position that if a series of inferences need to be made in order to the lesser included offense, then the facts in the record are not necessarily jumping off the page such that the lesser included offense is that what your argument is?
Yes, that is correct.
Is there anything you'd like to add, Ms. Casimir?
Nothing at this time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have you back for rebuttal. Ms. Bonfiglio.
Thank you, Your Honors. And may please report. The appellate panel here improperly sifted through the cold appellate record and constructed a conclusory and factually unsupported situation in which both defendants could be guilty of mere theft. But based on the actual testimony of this case and the two very different theories that were presented, There was no evidence, direct, circumstantial, inference, or otherwise, that would show that after lawfully defending themselves against a sexual assaulter, Rodriguez or Dunbrack, individually or in concert, decided to steal what they knew to be the unconscious assaulter's cell phone. Other than an armed robbery, there was absolutely no testimony about how the cell phone came to be in Rodriguez's pocket, nor was there evidence about the fair market value of the cell phone, which the state would be required to prove a mere theft. Another important fact that has not been mentioned in any of the briefs so far is that Dunbrack testified twice that after she sprayed mace in the closed car, the mace got on Rodriguez's eyes and burned his eyes, thereby causing him to pull over. So assuming her testimony to be true, we have mace in Rodriguez's eyes, a mutual fight with an alleged assaulter, a dark abandoned parking lot at night, and immediate flight upon seeing police. Under that version, Rodriguez could have took what he thought was his cell phone and ran. Therefore, there was no facts justifying a theft charge, and nor did theft clearly jump off the page, and the judge was thus correct not to charge it. Another important fact I want to mention is Rodriguez's counsel's summation. He did not admit the theft in summation. Instead, he equated Rodriguez's possession of the cell phone to blindly picking up items off after a fight. The words he used, basically he said, two people get in a fight. One's on the ground, one's unconscious, the other one walks away. If the other person picks up the cell phone and doesn't see it, that may be inappropriate, but that's not a theft. That's what was argued in summation, and that's important because neither defendant admitted the theft, and without that admission, a theft charge would clearly be inappropriate under the circumstances.
Counsel, I have his summation in front of me, so I just want to quote it, the part that you were summarizing. So he says, somebody's knocked out. However, after the fight, it's somebody's chain is broken and it's on the ground and the other person picks it up or their phone and they don't see it and they pick it up, that may be something that's not appropriate, but that's not a robbery. Because that's not a robbery. The inappropriate thing, he didn't want to say theft, but the inappropriate thing is clearly theft. He's running away with someone else's property. He's placed it straight out in summation. Am I mistaken?
I think so, Your Honor, because he doesn't say he took the other person's stuff. He says he didn't see it and he picked it up and walked away. And I think counsel for Rodriguez draws a comparison to State v. Lopez, which says that there can't be an afterthought robbery. But importantly, in Lopez, the facts there were that the victim and the defendant got in a fight and the victim died, and then the defendant took a chain off of the victim's neck. And then he also went further and said that he went through the victim's wallet, but it was empty. So in that case, the theft was admitted. Here, it's not admitted because in summation, which is the only reference to an alternative theory, he says, and you don't see it, and you pick it up, and you walk away. It's appropriate,
well,
but it's
he
not
had
robbery.
To explain to the jury. He knows that someone else's phone is on him, okay? So he knows he's got to explain that. And since they're going with Dumbrack's theory that she was sexually assaulted, that doesn't give Rodriguez the right to take someone else's property. So he was saying clearly in summation, hey, this wasn't a robbery, even though what he did was inappropriate. He committed a theft. This is right in his summation, and it's actually part of the discussion right before, during the charge conference, where Dumbrack's attorney is talking about some of the possibilities, one of them being that this is just a theft. Now, look, it's not for us to decide whether or not the state's case is a stronger case. That's not the issue. The only issue is whether or not, given the testimony, the defense was entitled to this charge. That's the only issue. Not whether or not the state inevitably would have won, even if the charge were given. The question is whether or not the charge was appropriate. Am I mistaken?
No, you're correct. But under either version, under the defendant's version or under the state's version, theft would have been inappropriate. They didn't admit the theft. They
said
you couldn't see
it. If you look at the statute, the mens rea is there. A person is guilty of theft if he unlawfully takes movable property of another with purpose to deprive him thereof. Justice Albin read from the summation. That can't be an admission to that his client committed theft or even anything, even if that were somehow dispositive, if it were, because the mens rea requires a purpose of taking another's property. Would
exactly
you agree with that?
Absolutely. And not only that, you need to know it's somebody else's property, and of course you need the purpose.
So what's interesting is in every criminal trial, the state is always arguing circumstantial evidence and draw reasonable inferences. Like, what reasonable inference would be drawn other than that Rodriguez unlawfully had the other person's property in his pocket? Like, what would Rodriguez be doing with the victim's phone in his pocket if it wasn't unlawful? That's what you would argue. The state argues every day in courts throughout the state, but not now?
No, Your Honor.
That's not
I
a reasonable inference now?
I don't think so. Not under these facts, Your Honor, because in this case, we have mace in his eyes. We have a dark, abandoned parking lot at night, and he immediately runs. We don't have anything to suggest that he knew it was the attacker's cell phone. He could have picked up what he thought was his cell phone. He has mace in his eyes. We don't know that he saw that it was his, and he just ran. The reasonable inference, I think, is that he, or at least that was shown and that was argued, is that he didn't see the phone.
So you're coming to Rodriguez's defense. This is interesting. You're saying, well, he may have actually had it lawfully, the phone. That's your argument? Okay.
Based on what was testified to, yes.
No, I think what you're arguing is this was an all-or-nothing case.
Exactly.
It's a plain robbery. Evidence is robbery. If they acquit him of robbery, they acquit him. He goes home. That's what you
exactly.
argue.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And finally, I would just like to say the Attorney General is concerned with the with presuming reversible error in this context, like the appellate division did here, because it will only serve to promote gamesmanship and sandbagging on appeal, which should not be tolerated, let alone encouraged.
Thank you. Mr. Blum.
May it please the court, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
The theft lesser was supported by Dunbrack's testimony that the fight was a response to the complainant's sexual assault and had nothing to do with taking property. The law in a nutshell is that if a fight is for reasons other than a theft, and the defendant takes property after the fight is over, then that is a theft, not a robbery. And here, Dunbrack's testimony supported an afterthought theft theory. She testified that the three were in a car, complainant sexually assaulted her, defendant struck complainant, defendant pulled over, defendant pulled complainant out of the car, they were fighting on the ground, defendant won the fight. As he was winning the fight, the cops came, defendant ran off, and then he's later caught with complainant's cell phone in his pocket. The jurors could conclude from this testimony that the encounter started as a fight and the defendant decided to take the cell phone after winning. And I point out, in response to some of the questions that were asked during the state's arguments, that circumstantial evidence is not of any less value than direct evidence, and sometimes it's more valuable. And you know, even though Dunbrack didn't specifically say she saw the moment when the phone was taken, she clearly testified the fight was for other reasons. Defendant ran off as the cops came, and he's later caught with complainant's phone in his pocket. So this inference is obvious.
So I want you to help me on that, because I'm struggling with it. It's not simply that Ms. Dunbrack doesn't say, "I clearly saw it." I'm paraphrasing the words you just used. She says, and I'm looking at page 68 of the testimony, "I don't know. How did they get there while they were fighting? The cash, the wallet, the passport? What do you mean? If Nelson is fighting Gabriel, who's putting his pants in the front seat of your car? I don't know. I can't speak on what I didn't see." So tell us, what part of her testimony, what specific passage in her testimony are you relying on that jumps off the page to support a theft charge?
The inference jumps off the page. I agree that there is no specific testimony that she gave, no testimony at all that she gave saying, you know, "I saw the phone taken." But her testimony is all about the fight and how the fight was for other reasons. Defendant runs off, and he after the fight's over and the cops are coming, and he's caught with the phone. And the inference we're asking to draw is a very clear inference. I mean, it's as clear as the inference that's given in the jury instructions in every case about, you know, if you wake up in the morning and you see new snow on the ground, you can conclude that it snowed during the night. This is as clear as that.
So the strongest part of your argument, if I am hearing it correctly, is he's got this in his possession after whatever it is, after this fight, he's got it in his possession. And from that, it's permissible to draw an inference that there was a theft to the level that it jumps off the page. Is that
position? I agree. I do think it jumps off the page, but let me deal also with the jumping off the page standard, because I think it's important to note that we do not agree that that's the standard. We think this was preserved here. Dunbrack's counsel specifically suggested justification and theft charges during the charge conference and explained how Dunbrack's testimony supported both. Yes, counsel was polite and used the phrase, you know, "just wondering," or the phrase, "just wanted to throw that out there." But that shouldn't mean that there's no preservation, you know, given the detailed explanation.
That's not a request to charge. And the charge was submitted to defense counsel. And they were asked, do you have any objections? It didn't have theft there. And they didn't request it. They may have done that strategically. I don't know why they did it. But I don't see how that was preserved when they approved a charge that didn't have theft, even if he threw it out there. So explain that to me.
Yeah, I disagree that that wasn't a request for charge, because what happened after Dunbrack's counsel explained how the evidence supported justification and theft is they got into a huge argument about justification and whether that was warranted, and they got bogged down in that argument, and they never returned back to the theft. But that discussion made it very clear that the sort of just wondering, just throwing it out there language really didn't have any meaning. Counsel was just being polite. Counsel really did want this.
He did want it.
Well, they did. They did come back to it the very next day. That's when the possibly a theft, I just want to throw it out there, phrase is used. So there's not one but two times that this is bandied about. And I want you to respond to this, because this is my concern. If the court on these facts says this preserved the objection, what message is that sending to advocates in front of the trial court? That all you have to do is muse aloud and suggest that I want to throw out a theory for you, judge, and that in all instances would satisfactorily be considered on appeal as a request for a charge? Is that really what you're hoping would be the law?
It wouldn't in all instances, but if you take the entire record into account here and the entire context of the conversation, and especially, you know, given that defense counsel, Rodriguez's counsel, later argues in summation, I mean, it's pretty clear that, you know, the theft theory was requested. And I would also, as a fallback, point to something that Justice Albin raised, that, you know, even if we're in clearly indicated land here, we decide that, you know, wasn't good enough as a request, still you have the fact that, you know, counsel explained this theory to the judge, suggested it. Defense counsel argued it on the summation.
Mr. Blum, how about at the end when the judge finished charging the jury and he said, does anybody have any objections to the charge? And all three attorneys said, no, we do not. Was it preserved at that point?
Well, that's...
Because when you finish the charge, is what every trial I've ever been involved in, at the end the judge says, do you have any objections to my charge? You go up to sidebar. And all three attorneys said, no. Should we disregard that?
Yeah, I think you should, because that is just a pro forma thing that's done in every case. And if, in fact, an issue
you
is
think
preserved...
That the judge, do you think the judge asked attorneys to come up? I'm sorry if I'm interrupting by asking you questions, but... I'm entitled to ask questions, okay? Do you think that the judge does that in every trial? There's a pro forma thing, not to see if there's anything required so the judge can modify the charge and discuss it further? You think it's just a pro forma thing?
If, in fact, assuming that a request was properly presented earlier, was properly made and denied, if the judge did that at the end of the charge, that wouldn't mean the request is waived. It would not. I mean, if the request is made, that would not waive it. So, I mean, I can't agree with that premise. And I would just, you know, I want to finish my thought before, which is, you know, even if we're in clearly indicated land here, in trying to decide whether this is clearly indicated, you could take into consideration the fact that, as Justice Albin said, this theory was presented to the judge on a silver platter. I mean, it shows how strange it is to think about this as a clearly indicated case, because the theory behind using a clearly indicated standard instead of a rational basis standard is we don't want the judge to have to brainstorm theories on his own that are too obscure without counsel's help. Well, this is
not. So you're
not
saying that
the
silver platter was the summation, Mr. Blum? Was the silver platter the summation?
Both. At the charge conference, Dunbrack's counsel very specifically explained why a theft charge is warranted, even if it's just a, you know, just wondering, as we put it.
Why wouldn't a trial judge who hears a theory in charge conference and then no follow-up, nothing is submitted, nothing's discussed, and then ask the respectfully, not a pro forma question, very important question, are there any objections to the charge? Here's your chance, counsel, make your record and gets a no. Why shouldn't that judge be able to reasonably assume that they were talking about this, but they, for what may be good strategic all-or-nothing kind of reasons, they decided against it? I mean, why should the judge then say, okay, I'm hearing no objections, but I think I'm just going to charge theft?
Right, I've kind of gotten off the preservation thing, and I'm under the clearly indicated standard. And all I'm saying is that even if we decide this is a clearly indicated case, in deciding whether something's clearly indicated, I think you should take into consideration the fact that not only did the evidence support this theory, but the theory was presented to the judge, was explained to the judge by Dunbrack's counsel in the charge conference, and then in summation, Rodriguez's counsel actually argues it. So I think all those circumstances should be taken into account in deciding whether this was clearly indicated. This was not a case that was left on his own.
But the critical piece of the three that you just referenced has to be what the evidence presented to the jury is. Would you agree?
I agree. And here, as you know, as I explained, the evidence did support it. And I want to answer, I guess, just a couple more things that came up on the state's argument, if I could turn to that. First of all, I just say in general that in deciding whether a lesser should be charged, you have to accept the defense testimony is true. So, I mean, any sort of arguments the state was making suggesting that you shouldn't accept the defense testimony, I think should be rejected. And also, I guess it was the Attorney General's argument that, interpreting the defense summation as, this wasn't a theft theory being put forward. It was a theory that, the phone was sort of blindly picked up by mistake. I don't see how it could be interpreted that way, because as Justice Alban said, defense counsel's arguing what happened was, quote, not appropriate, unquote. And he's doing it in the context of actually analogizing the Lopez case. So when defense counsel says they don't see it, I don't think he's at all saying the phone was blindly picked up. He's just confusingly using the third person plural. But I also want to say in response to that,
Mr. Blum, isn't he really just going along with the state's gamble? This is all or nothing. My only hope is it's not a theft and it's not a robbery. It was an act in self-defense, and he didn't take anything that wasn't his knowingly. So isn't he just going all or nothing? Because that's what the state's gamble was, sounds like.
If we're talking about the summation, no, I don't think so. I think counsel clearly put forward the theft theory in summation. He said,
well, so
picking
Mr. Blum,
up something he thought was his?
I'm
picking
sorry.
Up something he didn't know was the victim's?
No, I don't think that's what counsel's saying. I mean, the argument, remember, it's in the context of analogizing Lopez and saying that what happened was not appropriate. He says, if somebody's phone is broken and it's on the ground and the other person picks it up or their phone, he's analogizing Lopez, and they don't see it and they pick it up, that may be something that's not appropriate, but that's not a robbery. So, I mean, there's three uses of the third person plural here. I mean, one's obviously referring to defendant Rodriguez, one's obviously referring to the complainant, and then there's one sandwiched in the middle, which the prosecutor latches onto and says, that one's also referring to the complainant.
Mr. Blum, we've stated, assume that both the state and the defense wanted an all or nothing. We have specifically stated that the court has an independent obligation to give the appropriate charge. I'm quoting from Garin, but this is also our State versus Powell jurisprudence. The public interest in a correct verdict based on the evidence must trump the partisan strategic maneuvering of both the state and the defendant. And in fact, in Garin, the defendant did not want the lesser included. The state wanted it, and the court wound up not giving it, and we wound up saying that the court, if it's in the case, should even reject the defendant's denial of a request for the charge if it's there. Right. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, and that's just what I was about to say when I got cut off, is that, you know, even if I was to accept the prosecutor's premise that, you know, somehow, you know, this summation should be interpreted differently, still the court has an independent obligation to see that justice is done and that the defendant is convicted of the correct charge. There's a whole line of cases besides Guerin that says that, right? Guerin's not the only one. So the court would have had the obligation here because of what the evidence is, no matter what counsel's arguing. Let me see if I want to. I think we hit the high, unless the court has any questions, I think we hit the high points. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bum. Ms. Lord.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'd like to address three points, if I can, this afternoon as it pertains to our position here today. The first point that I'd like to address is what I perceive to be an issue of whether or not trial counsel requested the theft charge. The second point I'd like to address is essentially what we perceive the law to be for this case, and the third being I'd like to address the suggestion that the case law requires some type of a break in the chain of events before you can get a theft charge on a robbery. Or alternatively, to answer Your Honor's pointed questions, what facts support the theft charge? With respect to point one, that I perceive to be respectfully a mischaracterization of whether trial counsel requested the theft. So if you go back and you look in the transcripts, there's actually three separate and distinct areas where the charge was discussed. The first was pretty early on, and that was what has been designated as 3T in my brief. I'm going to give you the date as well in the event that there's some discrepancy with T from December the 8th. And on page 168, line 12. Now, this is, in fact, the prosecutor himself, Mr. Ward. At the end of the day, I think there are definitely some lesser included that are indicated by the evidence. Now, this is the prosecutor. He's the first one to suggest that lesser included exist here. Now, the only possible lesser included, and he says lesser included, it's plural. He doesn't identify which ones, granted, but it can't be one of a gun. So you have the robbery, and then you have it at the end. So it is the state who suggested the lesser included. And the court says we can decide that over the weekend. Okay, so that's cool. 14 is next court date. This is 12/13 and page 99. This is the second time they're actually discussing the charge. And the court says on line 15, other than that, is there anything else? And counsel for my client says, Judge, what about the lesser included? So now counsel for the defense is following along with the suggestion the day before, the trial court day before, of what was suggested by the prosecution himself, what about the lesser included? Here, interestingly enough, the defendant did not testify yet, Andrea did not testify yet, and he responds using the rational basis analysis. He says, well, I did not put a lesser included as it relates to the robbery because the question is there a rational basis for doing that, given the testimony as we've heard so far? And then he goes on page 100 to finally conclude. So I think, you know, I don't know that the lesser included theft is there's a rational basis for saying that. And it really doesn't apply to any of the other charges. That's in line 15. So we're sitting here utilizing the clearly indicated standard. In fact, the trial court utilized the rational basis standard and clearly took it as a request by the defense attorney for a lesser included. But it doesn't stop there. Moving on, Andrea testifies, and now we're in 5T. This is December 14th. This is when there's a third and final discussion with respect to the chart. So now Andrew's testified. Now Judge Brown has already said that he's not going to do the lesser included. So Mr. Hesketh, in a very polite way, because I don't know if anyone's ever appeared before Judge Brown, but after he retired, he's a very polite gentleman, very polite judge. And the two of them are being polite to each other, so to speak. And he's arguing before a judge who's already said, no, sorry, no rational basis for a lesser included. So asking the justification based upon Andrew's testimony, and then he goes in and he says, and possibly theft from a person or theft in general. And by the way, just to divert, the state suggests, or the attorney general suggests, that there has to be a value component, not for theft from a person. There doesn't have to be value. It's a third degree, as we all know. So now, for the second time, the defense attorney, but the third time in the transcript, saying, and possibly a theft from a person or a theft in general. And then he just does say, I want to throw that out there based upon Dumbrack's testimony. So what's interesting is that prosecution number one is the one to raise it. Second time, Hesketh says, hey, what about lesser included? And the judge says it's not a rational basis. Prosecutor's silent. Third time, they discuss it again. They revisit it after the defendant has testified. Prosecutor's silent again. So I have respectfully an issue with the prosecution suggesting it wasn't raised in the record, and in fact objecting to it now on appeal because they're the one who raised it and sat mute time two and time three. So clearly I believe it was raised below. Certainly the appellate division used a clearly indicated standard, and I respectfully suggest that it should have been a rational basis standard. So moving on to point two, which is what should the rule of law be?
Hold on, before you do that.
May I ask a, yeah.
Go ahead, Chief. I'll go.
Two things. I hope you can respond. The second passage that you read for us, you mentioned the prosecutor had no response after the judge explains what the judge is doing. I didn't see a response by defense counsel after the judge says, I don't see it. Is there one? Is there anything that remotely seems like a request by defense counsel in the passage on page 100?
So on page 100, the judge, he clearly not. He answers, I don't see it. But
so we don't have a request by counsel there. And that brings us to what I think, as you've described for us, is the more fulsome exchange at 5T on page 79. If this court, and I want you to try to step back a little bit from the facts here, if this court were to say, when an attorney says, possibly a theft here, Judge, I'm just throwing that out. If that is interpreted as preserving and requesting, what will the standard then be for future trials?
So that's very interesting, Your Honor, because that's exactly what my second point is, should the rule of law be for this case? And that is, I perceive this perhaps to be an ambiguous request for a lesser charge. As we akin ambiguous request to counsel. And here it was ambiguous. Perhaps it's being argued in artful, even half-hearted, as suggested by the prosecution. And putting all that aside, there's two options when there's an ambiguous request. Option number one is that you treat all ambiguous requests as a request, unless specifically withdrawn by the defense attorney. If you do, because you're putting it on the record, it's a rational basis standard, and it eliminates gamesmanship allegations, and eliminates possible ineffective issues down the road. And in fact, that is exactly what the trial court did here. Because when Judge Brown on the day said, I don't see there's a rational basis, he's utilizing that standard. He perceived it as a request, ambiguous or otherwise, and that's what he did. So that's option one. You can treat all ambiguous requests as the request.
Can I stop there? I'm really having difficulty following this argument because this judge was very meticulous. He was at various stages. He's talking with the attorneys about potential charges right to the very end. And then he gives the attorneys the charges to review. He gives it to them, they review it, and then he asks, do you have any objection? And they say no. And this is the point that the Chief Justice is raising.
Yeah.
How are we, the Chief Justice is saying, like, what standard will we have unless, with respect to the rational basis, I'm not talking about clearly indicated, unless there is a request to charge. The judge wasn't sneaking this by defense counsel. He gave it to them in writing in advance. So I don't know how we would operate with this if it's ambiguous. You give it against the will of the defense counsel and the prosecutor without discussing it with them. How does that work?
Well, that would go to the second option. It's just two questions in one. If I can just answer the first aspect of the no objection part, I have a different take on that. It's required by court rule at the end of the charge for the judge to call the attorneys at sidebar, and the jury's sitting in the box, and the court asks, is there any objection to the charge? Every time it's happened in my experience, I'm thinking he's asking, and I'm inferring from the situation that, is there any further objections to the charge that I just read? Sometimes you have a judge inadvertently call the prosecutor the defendant or a witness, or I've even had a judge say it was the defendant who has the burden of proof. So the point is, when the attorney's at sidebars and he's asked that very pointed question, is there any objection? The jury's sitting in the box. I don't have to sit there and re-argue my 15 requests that I did over the course of 2 or 3 days before, I would suggest.
I don't know how you can make that comparison. It's one thing for the attorney to have submitted a request to charge that is not incorporated, and then the judge says, do you have any other objections? And you say no. You've preserved it by submitting it. Or if you had previously gone on the record and said, I want that theft charge, and the judge said no, and then he gives the charge without the theft, you don't have to repeat it. That's not the situation here. No one requested the theft charge, period. They may have explored it. You know, I'm thinking about this. I'm wondering about it. But there was no request to charge. Am I mistaken?
I respectfully disagree. I believe that there was what's been referred to, what I characterize as ambiguous request, which gets into the second option the court can have, and that is, because you're concerned, should we shove it down their throat, so to speak, if they don't want it? I guess that's my language, not yours, obviously, but that was the import. To impose a duty on someone, whether it's the trial court or the prosecution, to ask, hey, what is your intent? Are you making a request to charge here or not?
Doesn't Rule 172 already do that, counsel? 172 says Rule 172, I think, already imposes that obligation on counsel to make known to the court specifically the action which the party desires the court to take and the grounds therefor. So there's no ambiguity, I don't think, in what the expectation is of counsel. I was a little perplexed earlier when you said we should be treating this somehow as if it's an analogy to ambiguous requests by lay people, defendants. This is an attorney operating, presumably, in accordance with the court rules. I don't know how much more clear the court could be.
Well, we have a situation here where the prosecutor argued it first, and then the defense said, hey, what about lesser included? And the court said there's no rational basis for it. And then he revisits it a third time and says, possibly theft in the person. I think the attorney perhaps thought that he preserved it successfully for the record.
Go ahead, Chief.
No, I want to try to wrap up this area, and I was going to say, I think your answer to Justice Albin earlier was spot on when you said, quote, I respectfully disagree. If we had that in the record in some way, then you're right. It would have been preserved. We would be in rational basis land. I would encourage you to continue your argument and move on to clearly indicated land instead.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Albin, did you want to follow up in this area before?
No. I was going to suggest that if something's clearly indicated, then the judge can shove it down the throats of counsel because he has an independent obligation to assure that the jury is properly charged. So with that, I think you should now go to clearly indicated land.
Thank you. So the third point is with respect to the state's suggestion that the case law requires a break in the chain of the events before you can get a theft on a robbery. And I would suggest that that's not true.
The only thing that's required is that the violence of the force be unrelated or unconnected to theft, as we know, as consistent with case law. So, and if there's a rational basis in the record for making the two unrelated, as a theft and the assault aspect of it, then it should be charged. So, what was a rational basis here? What was clearly indicated? Sorry, what was clearly indicated here? So, you know, it comes from two different avenues, two different ways it's clearly indicated here. One, let me remove myself from the facts for a second and look at the charge. The trial court here said, okay, we're going to charge justification. Okay, so what does he do? He charges justification. And in charging justification negates the assault aspect. You take robbery, you have the assault part of it here, and you have the theft part of it over here. So you have the justification negating the assault part. It's leaving the theft hanging by itself. What is a jury to do with that? They have no other option without being given the tools as to what to do with that with respect to the theft than to find him guilty of the robbery or not at all. I mean, that is the case law that's been identified in Harris. The jury's placed in a position where it's either to find the defendant guilty of armed robbery or acquit them, even though in this case Rodriguez had the victim's cell phone.
But Ms. Lord, had the jury in this case rejected justification, and the justification I think you concede was correctly charged, both types of justification, it would have acquitted the defendant of robbery, both defendants of robbery. If you look at the way the jury verdict form is, it would clearly have simply found the state didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no justification. That was charged very clearly to the jury, the proper burden on the state.
The problem I have with the charge with respect on at page 124 and 125 of the charge at 6T, when they talk about the justification, it's timeline. It's not clear. He tells them that it must be resolved by the defendant, and you must allow the claim of self-defense and acquit the defendant. But they don't tell him like what it's applying to, which element it's negating. And in fact, it doesn't say you can acquit him of robbery at all. In the beginning, it says, well, they're charged with robbery, the charge with theft, and then they just go into the justification. So it's not tied up to give the jurors guidance as to what to do with it.
There wasn't a theft charge. Right? it was robbery, and then it was the weapons charges, right?
Exactly. But the point is that if the jurors believed that there was a theft, but they weren't given the tools. I mean, they could very easily have found Rodriguez guilty of the theft and Dumbrack, because she didn't know anything about the phone, according to her testimony, not guilty of the theft, and acquitted them both of the robbery. I mean, that was a possibility, but that was foreclosed because of the lack of charging on the theft. So I believe that the basis of the clearly indicated aspect, or what created the issue to begin with, even more clearly, was the justification charge and negating the assault aspect and not giving the jurors any tools with which to do the theft element of it, what to do with it, which prejudiced the defendants in that regard. And factually, I mean, I agree with co-counsel completely. I mean, you have case law that talks about, what was it, Carrero? Recently, Your Honors decided that essentially the jurors don't have to agree with everything a defendant is saying. You can accept some, accept a little, did all. And I think that there's clearly indicated in the record, what you have here is that Rodriguez shows up at 7-Eleven with the cell belonged to him. Obviously, it's a theft. How did he get that? Then you have Andrea that says the fight had absolutely nothing to do with the theft. She negates the robbery altogether. So with that, if you have clearly a theft in the record and you have Andrea saying that the fight had nothing to do with the theft, there's an inescapable inference that Rodriguez stole the phone after the fight ended, or there's an inescapable inference that it was unrelated to the fight. And Andrea puts it there that the theft was unrelated to the fight. And with that, unless Your Honors have any additional questions.
Thank you, Ms. Lord. Ms. Casimir, did you want to offer a brief rebuttal?
Yes, thank you. Now, while juries, when they are examining the facts and evidence, they can make any rational inference. The clearly indicated test that triggers the sua sponte requirement duty of a trial judge to charge a lesser included offense does not rely on the judge's analysis of facts and inferences. Rather, in Savage, this court stated that only where the facts and evidence clearly indicate the appropriateness of the charge. And in fact, it states that the courts or the trial courts are not obligated to sift through the entire record to see if a combination of facts and inferences might rationally sustain a charge for a lesser included offense. Now, and also it requires that specifically in order to provide that that charge, it should be clearly indicated that specifically the jury could acquit of the greater offense and find guilty of a lesser included offense. Whereas in this case, we have plenty of facts in the record of evidence in the record that lends to a robbery having been committed, that lends to the phone being in Rodriguez's pocket after he exerted force on the victim in order to take his property, such as phone, wallet, money that was found on the front seat of the vehicle, as opposed to inferences would have to be drawn in order to determine if there was a theft as opposed to a robbery. And the clearly indicated standard does not require the court to make inferences in order to charge a lesser included offense sua sponte. Thank you.
You're muted, Chief.
Hello?
I will again thank you. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Thank you for the fine arguments. We're going to take the matter under advisement.